I want you to go back a little bit, just a certain hora on the births of the tribes. Remember, as we mentioned last week, according to almost all the Rishonim, according to Rashi, Leah and Rachel were only separated by a week, meaning to say that the 7 years that Yaakov worked for Rachel were not 7 years and then he married Rachel, but rather he married Rachel 1 week after the marriage to Leah, and then he worked 7 years after that point. So you might think, oh, so there's no big deal. So what did Rachel give up? She gave up a week. Like, what's so big deal that she gave the secret simanim, as it were? But you have to understand a few points. Point number one is that Rachel was not even batuach that Yaakov would marry her. Because, you know, Yaakov wanted to marry one woman. Now, it's not... Rachel does not automatically know that Yaakov is going to want to marry her if he's married to Leah. So therefore, in a sense, her Mesiras Nefesh was very significant, that she may have been giving up her whole chance. But there's another point as well. Ramban, there's a very famous Ramban, very important Ramban. The Ramban discusses the tradition of our Chachamim, that the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given. Right? Chazal have this Mesorah, that with Ruach HaKodesh, they knew the mitzvos of Hashem. Avraham wore tefillin and didn't wear shatnez, all of these different things. The Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given. So the Ramban raises a question, that if the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given, then how could Yaakov marry two sisters? Because non-Jews are allowed to marry two sisters. Polygamy is permitted, and two sisters are not one of the forbidden arayos under the seven laws of Noach. But to marry two sisters is forbidden under the laws of the Torah.
Are they stepsisters? Half-sisters?
Perhaps they were half-sisters, but the chara, that would be usher as well, under Jewish law, not under Noachide law. And if they kept all of the mitzvos before the Torah was given, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? This is a very, very famous question. There are a lot of answers. I'm not going to give you all the answers now, but I just want to give you the Ramban's answer. The Ramban gives the following answer. The Ramban says that because they were keeping the Torah on a voluntary basis, they weren't obligated, it's before Matan Torah. Because they were keeping the Torah on a voluntary basis, not an obligatory basis, they only kept the Torah when they were living in the land of Israel. When they were living in Eretz Israel, they were living in the palace of the king, they were living with this proximity to the Shekhinah, so then they kept the Torah. But when they were in Chutz La'aretz, they kept the Noahide laws, of course, but they didn't keep the Torah because they didn't feel they had to. Now, once the Torah is given, you can't make that distinction, because then Hashem says you got to wear tefillin here and there. But on the voluntary level that they did it, they only did it in Eretz Yisrael. So the Ramban says, since Yaakov married Rachel and Leah in Chutz La'aretz, he was permitted to marry two sisters, and then they get grandfathered in, that even when he comes back to Eretz Yisrael, he's allowed to stay married to them. But the Ramban points out that Rachel died right after Yaakov returned to Eretz Yisrael. And there are different reasons why Rachel died, but one of the reasons is that once Yaakov comes to Eretz Yisrael, he's not supposed to be with two sisters, so Rachel died. Now, if you understand this, then you understand that Rachel was actually giving up her life by being relegated to second place, because you're not allowed to marry the sister of your wife. Now, if you marry two sisters, who is your wife and who is your sister? Answer: who is your wife and who is the sister of your wife? Answer: your wife is the first one, and the second one is the sister of the wife. So when Rachel gave up the simanim, the identifying hand gestures, to Leah, knowing that eventually they'll be coming back to Eretz Yisrael, she is actually condemning herself to die. So you see, this was a real mesiras nefesh, because whoever was number two would not survive in the land of Israel because of the idea of achos isha. She would be the sister of the wife, and the avos in the land of Israel, they kept the whole Torah. Now, I just want to point out that Maharal does not like the Ramban's whole explanation, because the Maharal says, well, wait a second. If these are mitzvos that don't depend on the land, like the forbidden sexual relationships, they apply Chutz Laaretz and Eretz Yisrael. And if the avos are keeping the Torah, they should keep the Torah the way we have to keep the Torah. What gives them the right to make the difference? But the Ramban would say that since they're keeping the Torah on a voluntary basis, they can define it based on their relationship with Hashem. Okay, it's a very, very well-known Ramban. Okay. Now, let me mention, though, that there is a kasha on the Ramban from the beginning of this parsha, a very famous Rashi. Yaakov is coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Remember, how many years has he been gone? He has been gone 36 years. 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber. And 7 years he worked for Leah. And then he married Rachel and worked another 7 years. Right, so it's 14 and 14, 28 years. And then he works another 6 years with the sheep in order to build up his fortune. So that's a total of 20 years, and plus the 14, 34 years. And it took around 2 years or 18 months of traveling, etc. He finally comes back to Eretz Yisrael, and he thinks everything is going to be fine, and he gets word that Esav is going after him. Now, first of all, Chazal make a very important observation. Who initiated the contact between Yaakov and Esav? It actually wasn't Esav. Yaakov shows up and Yaakov sends a gift and a message to Esav. And then he hears, Esav is coming after you with 400 soldiers. Well, there is a Medrash that actually says that had Yaakov just ignored Esav and not even told Esav he was there, nothing would have happened. He's so afraid of Esav that he sends Esav gifts, implying that he's wealthy and the like, and that itself stirred up Esav's jealousy and antagonism. The Medrash quotes a verse in Proverbs, in Mishlei. Machzik biyaznei kelev over misaber al riv lo lo. That means, when you stir up a fight that you didn't have to get involved in, that's like pulling the ears of a sleeping dog. I don't know if you've ever tried this. You shouldn't try it. It's tzar bali chayim. But it's also dangerous. You know, a dog is sleeping. Hi, nice dog. You just pull the dog, these hounds that have these big ears, floppy ears, and you just pull the dog's ears. Well, what do you expect? Kids do that sometimes. That's how they get bit. What do you expect the dog to do? The dog's going to bite. Right? You're bothering the dog. So Esav was like a sleeping dog. What is Yaakov wakening up the sleeping dog? So according to the Medrash, Yaakov made a very big mistake in even initiating contact. He should have just done his thing. And he shouldn't have bothered to contact Esav. Other commentaries say the other way around. Right? This is a machlokas, I don't understand this. That Yaakov was very wise, because Esav would eventually find out that Yaakov is back. And Yaakov is preemptively devising a strategy. And remember, Chazal say that Yaakov had three strategies, three plans. Plan A and Plan B, but both plans need C. Plan A is send gifts and bribe him and be nice to him. Plan B is get ready for war, if necessary. And Plan C, which you always need, is pray to Hashem that you'll be able to deal with the enemy. So it's interesting that there's actually a machlokas in Chazal. Was Yaakov's proactive strategy of contacting Esav a wise thing or not? And it really has repercussions. Maybe not so much in Israel. Israel is a Jewish state, so by definition, Jews have a high profile. You can't escape that. But in the United States, people do often debate, you know, should Jews, especially religious Jews, should they get involved in politics? Should they take big public stands? Should they just kind of stay to themselves and not get involved? And that's kind of the machlokas. How do we deal with the Esavs? Do we kind of deliberately want to interact and connect? Or do we kind of say, you know, let's just keep our distance and the less we are involved, the better? And apparently Chazal themselves had two different views about this. But the very first message, the very first line of Yaakov's message, and you'll see why it's a kasha on the Ramban, is he sends Esav the following message. Im lavan garti, I have dwelt many, many years with Lavan. V'yechar adata, and I was delayed until now. And then he says, and I have donkeys and horse and the cattle and all of these things, etc. And I want to send you a gift. So Rashi says the following: Im lavan garti. Garti means I dwelt, but it's the same letters as tar yag, which is 613. Im lavan garti. So Yaakov is alluding to Esav. Don't think you can, even in his gift, he's being a little defiant. He's telling Esav, don't mess with me because I kept the 613 mitzvot even when I was in the house of Lavan. Do you see the drash? Im Lavan Garti is Taryag mitzvot shamarti. I kept the 613 mitzvot. Below lamadati mimasav haraim, I did not learn from the evil deeds. So the question is this: if that's what Yaakov is saying, I kept the 613, so don't mess with me, is that not a direct kasha on the Ramban? The Ramban says specifically that in Chutz La'aretz they did not keep the 613. And of course, Yaakov married two sisters. we see beferish. He didn't keep at least one of the 613. And the Ramban says he didn't have to keep any of the 613 when he's in Chutz La'aretz. So what does Yaakov mean when he says Taryag im lavan garti, which is Taryag mitzvos shamarti? Right, it's a kasha on the Ramban. So there's a beautiful teretz from the Chassam Sefer. The Chassam Sefer says, maybe we are mistranslating the word shamarti. Right? We translated shamarti, I have kept, I have observed. But there's another translation. And here we have to flash forward a little bit. In a few weeks from now, we're going to read the story of the sale of Yosef, Mechiras Yosef. And do you remember how the story begins? Yosef is 17 years old. And Yosef has two dreams that suggest he's going to be the king of his brothers. Remember, two dreams. One was the dream of the sheaves of grain are bowing down to his sheaf of grain. And the other is the stars and the moon and the sun are bowing down to him. And you know, Yosef has these dreams, literally, dreams of glory. I'm not going to say delusions of grandeur, because they were not delusions. They, in fact, all became true. But what does the Torah say the reaction was to telling people about it? Vayikanu bo echov. His brothers were very jealous of him. They resented him. They hated him. But the Pasuk says, Aviv, his father, Shamar Esadavor. He guarded those words. What does it mean, guarding the words? What does it mean to guard words? You can't guard words. Rashi explains, guarding the words means he was sitting and yearning and hoping that those words would be fulfilled. In other words, it was Yaakov's wish that Yosef should become great. So the Chassam Sofer says the following. Let's take that same word shamar and let's apply the translation to when Yaakov says shamarti, I kept the 613. It doesn't mean he observed the 613. When he was in Chutz La'aretz, he didn't. But he means for all of the 36 years I was not in Eretz Yisrael, every single moment I was yearning and hoping, when would I have the chance to come back and do these mitzvahs? You see what the Chassam Sofer is saying? The same way Shamar by Yaakov, by Yaakov and Yosef, meant he is waiting for the fulfillment of that dream. So when Yaakov says to Esav, I kept the 613, he means I'm waiting and yearning, when will I come back? And this is something that, you know, we have to try to feel. That is, even when we're in Chutz La'aretz, we're not in Eretz Yisrael, our heart has to be hoping and yearning. Now, of course, in a way, you know, we're hypocritical because, you know, we're living in Chutz La'aretz when we have a chance to come here, and we say, but my heart is yearning to come. Well, if your heart is yearning to come here, call up Nefesh B'Nefesh and come here. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, can't come, you know. Okay, be it as it may, I don't want to sound self-righteous. I mean, until 5 years ago, I was in exactly the same boat, so I'm not going to give people sermons about this. But the point basically is that a person's attitude is very, very important. And not only in Eretz Yisrael, but l'gabei all mitzvos. If you're ever in a situation where chas v'shalom, you're not able to keep the mitzvos in the perfect way, you don't simply say, forget about it, what can I do? You feel and you hope and you yearn and you wish and you pray that Hashem should give you the opportunity. And then Hashem counts it as if you're doing the mitzvah, because there is a statement that when you have a thought and a desire to do a mitzvah, Hashem counts it as if you actually did the mitzvah, if you truly desire. Did you want to say?
He was going to say, doesn't Yaakov's actions suggest that maybe he wasn't aware of the difference of the living obligation out in Chutz La'aretz? Because he wouldn't have tried to go back and if he knew that one of his like wives was going to die. So,
well, it could be like this. You know, one is not a proof. It could very well be that he didn't know that there would be death. You know, that I think he's aware, but he's not aware that there would be this drastic consequence. You know, marrying two sisters is not a capital crime in the Torah either. You know, so I think you're right. Yaakov may not be aware that this is going to happen, but that doesn't mean he wasn't aware that once he's in Eretz Yisrael, he has to. Actually, he doesn't have to, but he accepted upon himself to keep those commandments. Yeah.
Based on the Chassam Sofer's drushes, he's saying that it's not voluntary then, outside of in the Chutz La'aretz, they just don't apply at all.
Remember, once the Torah is given, they certainly apply in Chutz La'aretz. We're not talking about after Matan Torah. We're talking about before Matan Torah. No, I think before Matan Torah, everything was really voluntary, because the Avos were not commanded, except for circumcision, they were not commanded, but they accepted on their own to only keep it in Eretz Yisrael, because they felt closer to Hashem at that point. You know. Now, the truth of the matter is, there is another Ramban that actually says that even after the Torah was given, even though we have to keep the commandments in Chutz La'aretz, but the Ramban says that's only because Hashem wants us to remember what to do when we get back to Eretz Yisrael, which means the ultimate purpose of the commandments is only in Eretz Yisrael. You do it in Chutz La'aretz to be reminded so you shouldn't forget. That's a very, very amazing statement in and of itself. Now, again, so Yaakov's words are Im Lavan Garti. Rashi uses a phrase to explain Yaakov's words, Taryag Mitzvot Shamarti. I kept the 613, and we explained that with the Chassam Sofer. But then there's a second part of his phrase. You can memorize the whole phrase. Lo Lamadati Mimasav Ha-ra-im. I did not learn from his evil, Lavan's evil deeds. So here too, there are two explanations the Mefarshim say. I did not learn from his evil deeds. One interpretation is that Yaakov is speaking about a high madrega, that even though I was in such a corrupt, decadent environment, I did not become influenced by the negative environment around me. In other words, according to this, he's kind of telling Esav, I have merit, don't mess with me. He's kind of, I'm not going to call it boasting, but he's basically telling Esav, there are spiritual merits that you should not tamper with. But I heard from my own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ritterman Zatzal. I don't know if this was his interpretation or someone else's. He said that Yaakov is giving himself mussar. Yaakov is not complimenting himself. Yaakov is giving himself mussar. How so? Yaakov is saying, I did keep the mitzvos, but I didn't do it with the same enthusiasm as Lavan did evil things. Meaning, what do you learn from bad people? Sometimes you learn from bad people as well. Well, one thing you learn from bad people is what to avoid. But there are sometimes positive things you learn from Rishayim. And that is, do we bring the same enthusiasm and commitment to our good deeds that they bring to their bad deeds? For example, again, I don't even want to, like to use this example, but a suicide bomber, somebody, you know, evil person, a person who blows up children, and you know, the worst type of Russia, right? The sin is unbelievable. But here is a person who, in the interest of his evil cause, is willing to give up his life. We have to ask ourselves, are we as committed to the good as evildoers are committed to the evil? And we have to also learn passion and commitment and self-sacrifice and willingness to do whatever we need to do for Kedusha. So you look at a Russia, you look at Lavan. Lavan is ingenious and energetic in devising a million ways of cheating Yaakov. He never tires of it. Over and over again, right? When Yaakov says, you changed my salary arrangements 10 times, Rashi says, times is 10, so 10 times is 100 times. And there are Mefarshim that actually try to list 100 different things Lavan did. Right? So Lavan never got tired of it. So Yaakov is giving himself mussar. Yes, I kept the mitzvos, but chaval and alas, I didn't learn from the evil ways of Lavan how to do it with geschmack and enthusiasm and the like. Which is an interesting thing. This is what David HaMelech says. There's a pasuk in Tehillim that says, "Me oivai tachkimeni, make me wiser than my enemies." But there's a certain ambiguity in biblical Hebrew. The prefix mem can mean then, than, or it can mean from. So a phrase that says me oyevai tachkimeni can mean make me wiser than my enemies, but it can also mean make me wise from my enemies, meaning let me learn from my enemies how to serve you, Hashem. Let me take their enthusiasm, their passion, their commitment, and use it in a positive way. It's a real tragedy, in a sense, when someone takes all of those positive qualities and uses them for evil things. But we can reclaim those same qualities and use them for good things. And that's what Yaakov, my Rosh Hashiva, said. That is what Yaakov is doing when he's giving himself mussar and the like. Okay. But to go back a little bit, go back to Parshas Vayetze still, I wanted to share with you just two thoughts on the birth of the tribes, and they're really not related at all. Remember that God sees that Leah is hated. Now, first of all, hated is a mighty, mighty, mighty strong term. Is it Yitochen that Yaakov hated Leah? That is the word the Torah uses. Senua. First of all, let me point out, according to the halacha, it's a halacha. One is not allowed to have intimate marital relationships with a woman that he hates. This is a halacha, that if whatever reason a person hates his wife, God forbid, let's say he's even planning on divorcing her, but for the while they want to be together, or he wants to be together for his own lust, it is prohibited to have relationships with a woman that you hate under all circumstances. So how is it possible that Yaakov hates Leah and 6 of the tribes of Am Yisrael come from a hated wife? So the Mefarshim explain, and again, it's, you wouldn't see this in a literal reading, that hated is a relative term. It is not an absolute term. Meaning to say, as compared for the deep love that he had for Rachel, it was as if he hated Leah. But certainly Leah was not hated. Leah was loved. And of course, keep in mind the interesting idea that it is Leah that is buried next to Yaakov. It is not Rachel. And this is explained by the idea that God always stands up for the underdog. It's a verse in Kohelet. God protects the beleaguered and pursued person. The person who is shamed, the person who is humiliated, the person who feels like an outcast. That is the one that Hashem blesses. And that is why Leah has her children, 6 children. That is why she merits to be next to Yaakov and the like. And you'll see, though, that nevertheless, even though, again, we'll assume that she was loved and cherished, but she had a sensation that she was being rejected because of Yaakov's love for Rachel. And you see, even in the names of her children, how much pain. Again, it's very poignant, just not telling you any chidushim, just looking at the names, how much this pain troubled her. And she keeps on hoping, with every new child, the feeling is going to be different. Reuven, God has seen my suffering, Reu, and has given me a child. Shimon, God has heard my suffering, and has given me a child. Levi means to accompany or escort. Now that I have a child, my husband will stay with me. And then the 4th son is Yehuda. And Yehuda, she says, Hapam Ode Es Hashem. Now I am grateful. Yehuda, of course, is extremely important. That's the source of David HaMelech, Mashiach, all comes from Yehuda. Levi, of course, are the Kohanim and Levim. Now, what is the meaning? Why does she say, now I am grateful to Hashem? Now I am grateful. So there are 2 ways of learning. One way of learning it is, this is really a resignation and surrender to the way life is. Because if you look at the names of the 1st 3, she's looking for some other goal. Oh, now Yaakov will love me. Now God has heard my pain. Now my husband will be with me. By the time she has the 4th son, she realizes that Rachel is always going to be the closest wife to Yaakov. And how does one respond in life, generally, when you know you're not going to get what you want? Well, you want whatever you want to be. You want to be an Olympic, basketball player, or whatever you want to be. At some point, God bless and Torah, there's no end, keep on going. But at some point, a person realizes they're not going to be whatever Rebel Yashiv or whatever it is. Or they're not going to be the Olympic gold medalist or president of the United States or whatever it is you want. You can respond in 2 ways. You can kind of be bitter and resentful. Or you basically say, Hashem has given me many, many brachos. And I will look at what I have, and I will be grateful. So the insight of Yehuda is that Leah is no longer looking at children as a means to something else. You see, the 1st 3 sons, it's like, this is the way I'll get Yaakov to love me. The 4th son, she says, I am grateful for what Hashem has given me. I'm not looking at what else I will get out of it. That's a very, very big yesod in life. That look at what Hashem has given you and be grateful. Hakara Satov. Now, Rashi adds a very interesting dimension. Again, from the Midrash. Rashi says that Leah had Ruach HaKodesh. And Leah knows there are going to be 12 tribes. And she knows that the 12 tribes are going to come from 4 women. The 4 women are Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. So, mathematically, if you make it an equal distribution, each woman should have 3 sons. So when she has 3, she's just getting what she's entitled to. I'm getting three because I'm supposed to get three. There are four wives, 12 tribes. So you're not grateful for that. When you get what you're owed, so to speak, she was not yet grateful. But when she had number four, she got more than she was entitled to. Because as you know, the breakdown was not 3-3-3-3. The breakdown was 6-2-2-2. And she had three times more than any other wife. But she knew she was getting more than she was entitled to when she had number four. That is gratitude. Gratitude is when you get more than you really deserve. Now, let me tell you what the Sfas Emes says. The name of the Jewish people, we are called Yehudim. Now in the Torah we're actually called Bnei Yisrael, but in later times we still called Am Yisrael, but yet we're called Jews. Jews are Yehudim. Why are we called Yehudim? Yehudah was only one tribe. Right? Why is every Jew called Yehudim? Now one answer is because the 10 tribes were exiled and the dominant tribe was Yehudah. But the Sfas Emes says very beautifully, we are called Yehudim because Yehudah means I have gotten more than I deserve, and that's why I'm grateful. Every Jew must go through life feeling Hashem has given me more than I deserve. That attitude that Leah only had with son number four is an attitude that we have to have every minute of our lives. So quite literally, what is the translation of a Jew? A grateful person. It's not just a nice mida to be grateful. It is what it means to be a Jew. A Yehudi is Natalti Yeser Mechelki. And that's why every Jew, whether you Yisachar, Zebulun, Kohen, Levi, you are called Yehudi. A grateful person. Hakaras Hatov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not complaining about what we don't have, but looking at the brachos that Hashem has given us in all ways. Okay, so this is what the Sfas Emes says, and this is what we learn from this. So there are two, I think, very beautiful points, which really, they intersect. One idea is that with the fourth son, Leah was no longer using God's kindnesses as a means to get something else, her husband's affection. But there was an appreciation of the kindness in and of itself. And that's why, unlike the first three where she was alluding to, I want my husband to love me, she doesn't say it with son number four. She basically takes her life and accepts it as something beautiful. And the other message is the feeling that you've gotten more than you deserve. Again, these points intersect. And that's why she was grateful with son number four, because she figured the first three is coming to her. And again, these are ideas of Hakaras HaTov that are very, very important. That is why the Torah says further on, that many years later, that the nations of Ammon and Moab that come from Lot are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, because they did not give us food and water when we were traveling in the desert. But the Mefarshim say their real sin was that although they come from Lot, and Avram did so much kindness to Lot, they should have had Hakaras HaTov. And if they didn't have Hakaras HaTov, they cannot become part of the Jewish people, because a Jew by definition is one that has Hakaras HaTov. Okay, so these are some things to remember. I have one more point about the Shvatim. Maybe I'll save it for tomorrow. I have a little time. Actually, I do have a little time. So let me mention another thought. At least I'll begin it. And that is, all of these children are being born in Lavan's household. But then we are told that Leah had a daughter, and that daughter was given the name Dinah. Now, Rashi brings a very, very interesting medrash. The Medrash says that with all of the Shvatim, it says the mother got pregnant and gave birth. With Dinah, it just says Leah gave birth to Dinah. It doesn't say she got pregnant. Now, obviously, she did get pregnant. But Rashi explains the following. Rashi says, when Leah originally was impregnated, she was going to give birth to a boy. This would have been, this is after Rachel gave birth to Yosef. This would have been the 12th tribe. Leah prayed that it should turn into a girl. This is an example of gender switching. This was a boy that turned into a girl. And that girl became Dina. That's why Dina was born, but Dina was not conceived, because when she was conceived, she was a he. It was a boy. Why did Leah pray that the boy should be turned into a girl? Because every one of the maidservants, Leah had six already, six Shvatim. Every maidservant, Bilhah and Zilpah, had two each. Rachel only had one. If Dina would have been a boy, that would have been the 12th tribe. That would have left Rachel with only one Shevet. She would have been inferior to the maidservants. So Leah prayed that the boy should turn into a girl to enable Rachel to have the 12th tribe that became Binyamin, right? Binyamin was born on the way back to it, when they came back to Eretz Yisrael. So this is so interesting that you see how loving kindness gets repaid. Because Rachel gave the secret signs to Leah so that Leah should not be embarrassed and humiliated on the wedding night by Yaakov rejecting her. And now, many, many years later, Leah literally gives up the chance to have an extra tribe to spare Rachel the embarrassment of being inferior to the maidservants. You see, it's really a literal compensation back for all of that. Now, the way Rashi brings the Midrash, this was simply a switch, meaning this fetus was originally male and this fetus became a female. But in the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, Targum Yonasan ben Uziel actually gives us a different version of the Midrash, different than Rashi. It actually says that both Rachel and Leah were pregnant. Rachel was carrying a girl, and Leah was carrying the boy that would have become Yosef. And when she prayed, it's not that the gender was switched. The embryos were switched. Meaning, Hashem miraculously took the male embryo from Leah's womb and implanted it in Rachel's, and took the female embryo in Leah's womb, I'm sorry, in Rachel's womb, and gave it to Leah. See, different than Rashi. It's not that the embryo went from male to female. Rather, Hashem switched the embryos. Now, you might say, what's the difference? Well, this actually makes a lot of difference, because it turns out that Yosef was genetically the child of Leah, the egg from which Yosef was fertilized was Leah's egg, and Dina was genetically the child of Rachel. In other words, Dina was born from Leah, but she had been an embryo. She had been the fertilized embryo in the womb of Rachel. Now, the reason why this is fascinating, the reason why this is very, very fascinating, is that today we have modern technologies involving what's called a surrogate mother. Now, what's a surrogate mother? Again, halachically you're not supposed to use these things, but this is a technology that's available. Let's say a woman is unable to carry a baby. Right? A woman doesn't have a womb. Maybe there's a hysterectomy. A woman doesn't have a rechem. She cannot carry a baby. So there is, again, halachically you shouldn't use this, so don't use this. I'm just telling you what is possible. So one of the things that they have in the modern world is that husband's sperm fertilizes his wife's egg in vitro in a laboratory dish. And then there's another woman who volunteers to carry the baby for 9 months, and the baby is born, and then it's delivered to the couple. This is called surrogacy, surrogate motherhood. In Hebrew, it's Eim Pundakait. That basically means the mother is like an innkeeper. She just holds the child for 9 months. Now, according to halacha, there's a massive question. Who is the halachic mother of the child? Is the halachic mother of the child the one who gave the egg, because that has the DNA that are the characteristics of the child? Or is the halachic mother of the child the one that carried the baby for 9 months? Now that's enormously important, because whether a child is Jewish depends on the mother, not the father. So if, for example, again, halachically don't do this, but I'm raising theoretical questions. If, for example, the sperm and the egg are from a Jewish couple, but the Aim Pundakayit is a non-Jewish woman, if I follow the birth mother, the child is a goy who would have to be converted as a baby. Babies can be converted. But if I follow the egg donor as the genetic shorish of the child would be Jewish. So there's a huge, huge machlokas haposkim. If motherhood, maternity, halachically, is defined by the genetic contribution, which is the egg that's fertilized with the sperm, or whether it's based on the parent that carried the baby for 9 months. Very, very difficult shaila. So some want to bring a raya from Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, because it turns out Dina was genetically conceived in Rachel's womb, and Yosef was genetically conceived in Leah's womb.
Yosef.
Binyamin was born. No. Yosef. Yeah, Yosef and Dina were switched. No, Binyamin was born from Rachel later. So it turns out that Leah was the egg donor for Yosef, and Dina was the egg donor of Rachel. Rachel was the egg donor of Dina. And yet, the Torah always tells us Yosef was the son of Leah. I'm sorry, Yosef was the son of Rachel, and Dina is the daughter of Leah. So what do you see from that medrash, Targum Yonasan? That maternity is not based on genetic origin. It is based on birth mother. If that's the case, if the Pundakait is a non-Jew, the child would need a conversion, even though the egg and the sperm are from a Jewish couple. Now you see, it's an amazing thing how the Targum Yonasan is actually a proof on the surrogate mother. Now, according to Rashi, it's not a proof, because in Rashi's version, there was no embryo switching. Hashem just changed the female to the male. But like Targum Yonasan, embryo switching. Now, I have to say right off the bat that this is a medrash, and it is brought down that we don't learn halacha from midrashim, because they could have symbolic meanings. But it's just an example of a medrash that you might think is far-fetched, God forbid, and yet it has mamish relevance on a concrete halachic question that exists even today. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow.